This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton discusses the issues before the new Congress next year. But first, former Western Michigan University trustee George Franklin recently published a book, Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars, 30 Years of Lobbying for the Most Famous Tiger in the World. In it, Franklin describes what he learned during a long career in government relations at the Kellogg Company. He says it's a deliberately short read meant to offer practical advice on influencing policymakers. Franklin spoke with WMUK's Sevilla Mann about some of the battles he fought on behalf of Kellogg and what he thinks the public misunderstands about lobbying.
What is it that you want readers to take away from Cereal Wars specifically?
I want them to have a feel for what you really do as a lobbyist. There's some great misconceptions about it. I mean, the one I get all the time is people have this sort of Jack Abramoff image of lobbyists. They're shady characters that, you know, make deals in the middle of the night.
Jack Abramoff was the lobbyist who was convicted of some kind of corruption, pretty major corruption.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the reality is it's exactly the opposite. What you deal in is trust and candor. And if you don't have the trust of the politicians you're talking to, you're going to be out of business. I can go to Fred Upton or Debbie Stabenow or Carl Levin and maybe pull a fast one time, but I'm out of business at that point. And what they need to know is that when I come in, they can trust what I'm telling them. I'm going to give them the facts. I'm going to give them the pros and the cons of the issue. And I'm also going to give them the politics. I'm going to tell them about who's going to be happy with them, but also who's going to be upset.
Doesn't that image, that misconception, doesn't it have a grain of truth in it? And that when you've got lobbyists for every industry, you have people who they may be candid with the politicians that they need the support of, but what it is that they're advocating for may not necessarily be beneficial to the public as a whole.
Well, you know, that is something I always get a kick out of, too. When people say, are you pro-business? Is a congressman or senator pro-business? I have no idea what pro-business means. 99% of the time, I don't know what they're talking about. If you're for bringing generic drugs in from Canada to lower healthcare costs and you're General Motors, that's pro-business. If you're Pfizer, that's anti-business. If you're for putting a limit on the swipe fee on debit cards and you're Macy's or the neighborhood bookstore, that's pro-business. If you're for putting a limit on swipe fees for debit cards and you're Visa or MasterCard, that's anti-business. Depends on what business you're in, okay? And you know, people try to simplify it, pro-business, anti-business, and it's usually a lot more complicated than that. And the other thing is, and once again, people don't want to hear this. Most of the politicians are pretty decent, honest, straightforward folks. They're our neighbors. They live down the street. They came where we came from. But the issues are incredibly complicated. They're just not that simple. And I have a quote in there. Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York, always loved this. He said, if you're with me on 9 of 12 issues, vote for me. If you agree with me on 12 of 12 issues, see a psychiatrist. Well, that's the reality. And you have these people running for office now who say, well, I'm going to go to Washington. I'm never going to compromise. Well, it's patently absurd.
When it comes to this misconception, as you say, of lobbyists in the public eye, some of it surely comes from this perception that corporations, companies, business has all this money and they're throwing it at the government. They're buying influence. There's a general perception that politics is just awash in money and that maybe the private interests really hold the strings.
It is awash with money and it's totally out of control. But barring changing the United States Constitution, I'm not quite sure what you do about it. I find it offensive. I think a lot of people agree. But as I said, barring changes in the U.S. Constitution, there's not much you can do about it. The role of money is a little bit of a misconception. And what happens is you've got almost an infinite number of people trying to see someone in a finite amount of time. So you're the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. and you're rewriting the tax laws of the United States. Well, there's massive amounts of money that come into play the way you write the tax law. And so there's all sorts of interest that are trying to get to you to persuade you to write that tax law to their benefit. And it's not just business. It's labor. It's environmental groups. It's activist groups. These are all special interests. You know, special interest is the name you use when someone's opposed to you. Okay? That's where special interest means. So there's all sorts of special interests. But what happens is human nature takes over. And you're the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and you've got 8 hours in the day and thousands of people trying to see you. Well, you can either see the people that have supported you, help you get elected, and have been involved in, you know, your campaigns, or you can see people who are total strangers you don't know. Well, human nature is the person that's been involved, been a contributor, been active, been supportive, is going to come in the door. I would argue, though, you could have incredible amounts of money and constituents, grassroots, still win over.
What was the most challenging thing you ever had to convince a policymaker to support?
I think advertising to children is always, it's just a gut. There's a visceral dislike people have for advertising to children. The problem is they're not against advertising to children. They're against advertising what they don't like, which is a big difference. If we were advertising broccoli, spinach, and carrots, all the do-good groups would say, that's wonderful. That's what you ought to be doing. It's a selective opposition to advertising to children. And then you get into, once again, you have this little problem called the First Amendment, which sort of interrupts what people's ability to restrict advertising is all about. But that was a difficult one. It's an ongoing one. And I talk about that in the book now. And it's been going on since 1969, when a Republican activist named Robert Choate testified in front of the Senate committee against advertising to children, to a year ago, 2 years ago, Michelle Obama talking about restricting advertising to children and asking the industry to self-regulate themselves. It goes on and on. And I quip in there, it's the issue that keeps sending lobbyist kids to college. Because on both sides, there's interest groups on both sides, and the activist groups use it as a cause célèbre.
You know, I see on Kellogg's website, the point that's made seems to be more that breakfast cereal has less sugar in it than many other sugary foods that kids eat, rather than it's our First Amendment right to sell sugary stuff to kids.
Yeah, I'm not really, you know, here representing Kellogg's. I don't feel comfortable addressing that, so. You talk to Kellogg about the Kellogg website. I don't work there anymore, so.
I do want to explore just a little bit more, though, this issue that you write about in the book extensively. I think there's a whole chapter on it about the sugar industry and the issues with subsidies, but also this battle about advertising to children. You know, you've said that legally that's the right of companies to do that. But I wanted to ask you, at the same time, it seems like it might be hard to find somebody who said they thought, you know, that their First Amendment right protected their right to sell cigarettes to children or alcohol or guns or something like that. So I'm wondering where exactly that right leaves off and the interest of the health and the safety of the children comes in.
Well, I mean, these are basically nutritious, wholesome products that have been eaten for years that most companies regard as something that's a, you know, complement to a normal diet that is not harmful. And there's really no issue. Like, it's a strained analogy to talk about alcohol, tobacco, and firearms compared to Frosted Flakes.
Would you say that the First Amendment would cover your right to advertise those things, though, to kids?
I'm not, no, I don't think so. I don't think I'd say they could advertise that to kids.
But cereal,
I mean,
yes.
I mean, there are limitations on, everything's got a limitation in the First Amendment. Can't cry, you know, fire in a crowded theater. But it's a whole different realm you're talking about there.
There's a point where you write, sugar's not nutritionally beneficial other than providing calories. Are you saying there that sugar's not good for you? Or are you saying it's basically benign?
Well, it makes things taste good. And if it doesn't taste good, people don't eat it. I can remember, you know, you do what's called market basket surveys, and people would go into a grocery store and they'd tell you all these things they were going to do. They were going to eat less of this, less of that, more of this, more of blah, blah, blah. And then you stop the same people when they're walking out of the grocery store and look at what they bought. It had no correlation between what they told you going in and what they left with. So the reality is, if things don't taste good, people don't eat it. And sugar helps make things taste good. And that's one of the purposes that's in there, in addition to providing calories.
Does it concern you at all, the potential role of sugar and those higher rates of childhood obesity and diabetes?
Well, you know, I'm not a nutritionist equipped well enough to really respond to all that. I mean, I always felt comfortable advocating for the products we sold. They were good, wholesome, nutritious products that have been part of the American diet. And adults, kids, young, old, have been eating it for years.
This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We are speaking with George Franklin, the author of Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars. He says readers who can only spend a few minutes with the book might want to see the section on how the Kellogg Company, where Franklin was a lobbyist, handled its business in South Africa during apartheid.
Both Upjohn and Kellogg were adamant that they were going to not leave South Africa, that we could effectuate change more by being there than by leaving. Well, it just so happened, and a lot of our listeners will know this person, there was a former professor here from Western named Howard Wolpe, who became the congressman. And he was a very honorable, decent guy. And Howard became chairman of the Africa subcommittee. Well, he was the major proponent of divestiture. He wanted all the American companies to leave, and he thought that would be the most effective way to eliminate apartheid. So you had these two major employers in Howard's district at cross purposes with him, the chairman of the Africa subcommittee. Well, this was not lost on the South African government. They understood the domestic politics. They understood the importance of Upjohn and Kellogg. And they also understood our presence here in Howard Wolpe's district, which gave us license, us being Kellogg, license to do things that we may not have been able to do. So we became the first company to recognize a black trade union headed by a fellow named Christopher Lamini. Well, Christopher Lamini was the first vice president of what you essentially called the black AFL-CIO. It was called CASATU. And he was also on the much wanted list by the South African government. Well, one night I got a call from our plant manager in Springs, South Africa, that the state police had taken Christopher away from his township, and we had no idea where he was. And this is at a time when people magically and mysteriously fell out of windows when they were in prison and magically didn't wake up the next day. And it was an evil, horrendous situation. Well, I called our then CEO to let him know that Christopher had been taken. We were very worried about where he was. And our CEO was a fellow named Bill Lamothe. And he said, okay, I want you to get a message to President Botha, P.W. Botha, whose nickname was the Crocodile. Okay, big, tough Afrikaner guy, right? And he said, I want you to get a message to P.W. Botha, that if Christopher is not released in 24 hours, I'm going out and holding a press conference. We are leaving South Africa. I went, whoa, this is way over my pay grade. So I said, you sure you want me to do that? He said, absolutely. If Christopher is not released, I'm holding a press conference. We're leaving. So from my Washington activities, I knew the ambassador from South Africa, the United States. So I called his office and passed along that message that if Christopher is released, this is going to happen. Well, Christopher was released. And each year, I'd go to South Africa three or four times to make sure that we were doing the things we claimed we were doing. And each time we would meet with Christopher, and he would say, if Kellogg had not intervened, I would not be alive now, which I'm sure was the case.
Did the people who wanted Kellogg out of South Africa at that point, after that had happened, did they change their minds?
We didn't talk about our role in getting Christopher released because if we had done so, it would have embarrassed the South African government and been counterproductive. You can talk about it 10 years after the fact, after apartheid's over. But I can assure you when it was going on that Christopher and his colleagues knew what had happened. And it made a huge difference.
George Franklin, author of Raisin Bran and Other Cereal Wars, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Former Kellogg executive George Franklin spoke with WMUK's Sevilla Mann.